I remember many years ago now driving with a friend from Canberra to Sydney. I don't know whether you know the geography there, but it's about a three-hour drive. It's quite a long time ago. I was quite young, and I need to say that because of what I'm going to tell you, because it's an embarrassing, minor embarrassing thing. There we were driving. I was driving. He was asleep. And we were driving along, and I noticed that the red fuel light came on. Anyway, I just kept on driving, and Craig, my friend, was asleep. And then the red light started to flash. Anyway, I kept on driving, and you'll never guess what happened. Do you want to guess what happened? The car stopped. And my friend woke up, and asked what was happening, and I said, look, I'm not sure, but I think we might have run out of petrol. To be honest, I don't know what I was thinking that day. What was I thinking? But I just thought it just might be easy just to keep going and wait for a petrol station to come up, and it never did, and there we were on the side of the road. It's very embarrassing. But it's a good analogy of what life can be like sometimes. We're going along, we're feeling lacking in resources, we just keep pushing through, and sometimes we just get to the point where we just conk out. We're tapped out. We have no more resources. We're completely depleted. And again, it might be for all sorts of good reasons. It could be about family, it could be young kids, little kids. I mean, they can tap you out, can't they? They can exhaust you. Or it could be our elderly parents. My parents, my dad is 90, my mum is 85. My mum is actually going through radiotherapy for breast cancer right now. And, you know, so life can, when you get older, life can really start to weigh you down because of age. It could be all sorts of things. I think COVID has meant that a friend of mine in Bible study, she shared that she just couldn't get her mojo this year. You know, we're into May and she felt like she really should have got a little bit more of a groove happening and she just couldn't. And I have a feeling a lot of people feel like that. We just can't seem to find our mojo. We just feel a little bit, you know, like blah, apathetic. And I think, you know, we might be feeling like a holiday, but we're not sure we can plan for one because what happens if the flights are cancelled or we get COVID and we can't even afford it because, you know, money is tight because of business and so on. I mean, life has a way of making us feel exhausted physically, emotionally, maybe even spiritually. Like you've got nothing left in the tank. And so you might be feeling this morning spiritually very, very dry. Yes, we can go through the motions. Yes, we can open the Bible. Yes, we have the right answers. But deep down, you're feeling very dry. And we look ahead and we think, okay, I've got to find something to look forward to. You're looking for that light at the end of the tunnel. A friend of mine said she was looking for a light at the end of the tunnel when she was going through a really hard time and she saw it, but then she found out that it was actually an oncoming train. In other words, it just got worse. Life can be like that. What do we do? What do we do when we feel like we're at the end of our resources, when we feel like we're so depleted? What do we do with that? Just keep that in mind. As we come to round two of Ruth chapter two, we're going to do the same thing. You've got your outlines there. We're going to think about context, which is pretty much chapter one. So we've pretty much covered that, but we'll just recap. We'll look at the flow of the story. So Maureen read the first seven verses, but we're going to look at the whole chapter. And then we're going to ask the question, what do we learn? It'll be about God. And then we'll think about, well, what do we do? How do we respond? So that when we leave here, drive out into Clayton and beyond, will our lives look any different? Having opened God's word this morning and thought about who God is and what he's done and what we learn here. So we're going to think about how we respond. So, story so far in the book of Ruth. Well, it starts with what? What does it start with? A famine. And we're in the days of the judges. And there's a famine in the land. There's a little family where they move to Moab. And so they leave the land of their inheritance. They go to a land where they're not known. They're there for how long? 10 years. Oh, gee, you guys are really good listeners. And then what happens? Why does Naomi return? The Lord had visited his people and she heard about that. I couldn't hear the answer, so I'm just presuming that's what you said. The famine was over and so we have a returning. There is a returning, and the returning is Naomi and Ruth. Ruth making that amazing commitment to Naomi and to the Lord that she's going to be there forever. So there's a leaving, there's a returning, and Naomi is now home. Now, Naomi is now called Mara because she's bitter. She feels empty. So she's home, but she's not kind of going, woohoo. She's just basically, you know, in a real pit. Life looks pretty hopeless for Naomi. But there is a glimmer of hope. What's the glimmer of hope? The barley harvest is about to begin. The famine is over. Good. So you've given me the context there. So we've got the context of chapter 1. Now we move to chapter 2 and we read in chapter 2 verse 1, now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. That's interesting information. It's very interesting information because we have a worthy man of the same clan. And it's a relative, so it's a relative of her husband's. Now, we have to make sure we understand that this information is for us. It is not yet for Ruth and Naomi. It reads like, you know, they'll know this, but they actually don't know this. Just like those first five verses in chapter 1 were FYI, this is a hopeless situation. This is an FYI in chapter 2 that there is a man, a worthy man, Boaz, and he's there and he is part of the family. He's a redeemer. But this is something that Ruth and Naomi don't know, and you'll see as you read through the chapter that they don't know. And in the Old Testament narrative style, this is called the reader's advantage. In other words, we're being told by the narrator that this is a situation, but it's a kind of like a us to know, them to find out situation. Ruth and Naomi will find out, but at this point, they don't know. So we have a worthy man, a relative of Elimelech there in Bethlehem, verse 1. Then we come to verses 2 to 3 and we read that Ruth takes the initiative to go out and glean in the fields. Naomi is kind of just in the corner, rocking back and forth in the fetal position. Well, it doesn't say that, but that's what I picture her being, or in bed and just in a darkened room. And Ruth goes, Naomi, I'm just going to go out and glean in some fields. And Ruth says, you know. So Naomi's not in a good space. Ruth is taking the initiative, and she has to take the initiative because they need to get food. This is a hand-to-mouth kind of culture anyway. They need to get food. There is no government assistance. So Ruth is the one that takes the initiative and goes out. She doesn't know that Boaz exists, nor does Naomi, it would seem, but she goes out to glean. Now, gleaning is something that the poor and the vulnerable people did in these kinds of cultures, agricultural cultures. It was actually built into God's law. If you read in Leviticus, you'll read that they're instructed not to go back, double back and pick up the leftovers. They were to be left for people who didn't have anything. So this is something like government assistance, but it's actually from God. This is part of his law. So Ruth says, I'm going to go out to glean. We know there's Boaz. We're going to meet him soon. Ruth says, out I go. And where does she go? Well, as it turns out, would you believe it? She ends up in part of Boaz's field. So let me just read those verses again as you start to get your bearings. Verse 2, and Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favour. In other words, after someone, if someone lets me, just some, I don't know who, just try and find a field where I can do that. Naomi says, go, my daughter. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. Where we read she happened, it's literally her chance chanced. It's like the narrator, the author, he's using irony. And he's saying she happened to go to a field belonging to Boaz without any intention of her on her part to go to this field. There she is, gleaning in this worthy man who's part of the clan of Elimelech. So what we're looking at is not lucky coincidence, but we're looking at the work of the sovereign and compassionate Lord, who is at work in these circumstances, behind the scenes, directing and controlling and providing for his people, including Ruth, the Moabitess. And then we come to verses 4 to 17, and we read how Ruth and Boaz meet. And by the way, I think sometimes we often think about Ruth and Boaz, that's the ultimate love story. I think there is a love story there. I think, actually, I said to someone at morning tea, I think that the book of Ruth, there are three love stories. There's the Ruth and Naomi love story, that commitment, that cleaving to. You've got the Ruth and Boaz. There's also that a beautiful coming together. But over and above all of that is the love story of God and his people. And what we're watching is the unfolding of that love story of how God redeems his people through this little family in Bethlehem. And what we're watching now is how he's bringing this to pass. So verses 4 to 17. And what I've got in your outlines there, I've got a word there, hesed. And there's a whole lot of hesed happening in these verses. Hesed is a word in Hebrew that means, it can be translated steadfast love, or it can mean faithfulness, or it can mean covenantal loyalty. And it's most often used in the context of God as he relates to his people. So you won't see it. When you read steadfast love, the word is hesed. And when you think about Ruth, and in chapter 2, what you've got, particularly in chapter 2, but all over Ruth, you've got hesed bubbling over. There's steadfast love. There's faithfulness bubbling over at every turn. And we see a whole lot of that here. Let me just read some of these verses again. So we've got Ruth, who happens to be in the field belonging to Boaz. And behold, guess what? Would you believe it? Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "Well, she's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came and she's continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." So let me read a little bit more. This is when they meet. So then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you?" It was quite common in those days for women to be harassed. It was a very dangerous place for a young woman to be, gleaning in the fields. And perhaps even she'd already been harassed. Boaz says, "I've told them not to do that." And he says, "And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." So we'll stop there for a minute. So we've got Boaz. We meet Boaz. We know he's a worthy man. We see him greeting his workers in a godly way. "The Lord be with you." He learns that Ruth is a hard worker. She's described as someone who is actually working hard in the fields. But we also learn something of Boaz's character. I love Boaz. I think, what we read of him, and especially when you come to chapter 4, beautiful. We know he's a worthy man. He greets his workers in a godly way. He realizes and is generous with Ruth in terms of her gleaning. He insists she stay in his field. He instructs his man not to harass her. And he provides more and more in terms of food and water for the day. We learn that he is generous. We learn that he is kind and godly. And you know what that is? Hesed. Why was he like that? I mean, we know he's a worthy man. Why was he being so kind and generous? He was going above and beyond here. Why did he act the way that he did? Well, probably because that was his character. He was a worthy man. But we also learn in chapter 2 of what he had heard of Ruth's cleaving to Naomi. He'd learned about Ruth's hesed to Naomi, how she had declared, "Where you go, I will go, and your God will be my good." So have a look at verse 11. This is what he says to her. "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me." Somewhere along the line, he's heard about Ruth. "I've heard how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before." He knew the cost that she had paid. And then we come to what I think is the central verse of this chapter, verse 12. He says, "The Lord," that's covenantal, relational language, "the Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel," and listen to this, "under whose wings you have come to take refuge." What a beautiful picture that is. And you see it in other parts of the Old Testament too, taking refuge under the wings of Yahweh. That's where Ruth was. Yes, she was gleaning. Yes, she was a young widow with no prospects. Yes, she had a mother-in-law who was, you know, rocking in the corner of a room of a house without any idea of what was coming next. Yes, she had no idea about the future, but looked pretty grim. And yet all the while, she was sitting securely under the wings of Yahweh, the one who is sovereign, compassionate, and full of hesed, steadfast love. And Boaz, in his generosity towards her, was the instrument by which the Lord was rewarding her and blessing her. So may the Lord reward you. Well, actually, Boaz, you are part of that reward of blessing. So what Ruth was experiencing, whether she could articulate it or not, well, she was experiencing the steadfast love of God, the hesed of God, that came through the hesed of Boaz because of her hesed to Naomi. So hesed, hesed, and more hesed, and you've learned a Hebrew word in the process. And as we read on in this chapter, we read of Boaz's generosity with the midday meal. Let me just read a few more verses for us as we go along. I'll pick it up at verse 14 at that mealtime. Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." I'm wondering what the others are thinking at this point, because he was going above and beyond. So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. She ate until she was satisfied. There's an empty and a full happening here. And she had some left over. And when she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean among the sheaves and do not reproach her. And also pull out some of the bundles for her and leave her it for her to glean and do not rebuke her." So again, not just the leftovers, but let's make some leftovers for her. So she had lots. And then I'll keep reading a bit more. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. So what... Again, with the empty and the full, she came empty. She had nothing. She was going to glean whatever she could get that day. What she ends up with is an ephah of barley. Now, an ephah is about 9 kilos. It is enough for 2 people to eat for a whole week. It's like she went into the supermarket with no money and a shopping trolley. She came out with a shopping trolley overload, over full with food. Imagine her wheeling that back to Naomi. So there's that empty and that full playing out. She went there empty. She came back full. I reckon that when she came back to Naomi, Naomi's eyes must have been popping out of her head, looking out the window going, what? So beyond any expectations that Naomi would have had. I mean, verse 19, Naomi says, where did you glean today? See, she didn't know about Boaz. That's how we know for sure that verse 1 is the reader's advantage, not for Naomi at this point. Where have you worked? Verse 19. Oh, blessed be the man who took notice of you. I don't know who he is. I don't know how you got there, but wow. Blessed be that man. There's a sense in which if she was, Naomi was in the fetal position, rocking back and forth in the corner of the room, suddenly it's like she's coming awake. She's suddenly seeing the potential. She's suddenly realizing that the God who is sovereign is also the compassionate one. It's like, you know, you've got a dried out plant, flower, and you pour water on it, and sometimes it just sort of comes up. That's how I picture Naomi, waking up from the despair of the last 10 years, starting to take notice, starting to look around going, hang on a minute, well, this is not as grim as I thought it was. Especially when she hears where Ruth has been working. Verse 19, so she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, well, the man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. And it's written in that order in the original. In other words, it's like we're going, yes, yes, who? Boaz. So we all go, woo, yes. And so does Naomi. Let me just read some of those verses to you. Verse 20. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, oh, may he be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi also said to her, well, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. So suddenly the pennies dropped for Naomi. And it's interesting when she says, may he be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. She's wanting Boaz to be blessed by the Lord, but it's a little bit ambiguous as to whose kindness she's referring to. Is she referring to the Lord's kindness, or is she referring to Boaz's kindness? Because you can read it both ways. But perhaps the ambiguity is deliberate, because both Boaz and Yahweh, through Boaz, there is that beautiful hesed that is occurring, that compassion, that kindness, that love towards these two vulnerable, helpless women. And what's more, Naomi says, well, this man's one of our redeemers. I mean, how lucky is that? Well, we know it's not lucky at all. Luck has nothing to do with it. It is a providential care of God who is working out his purposes for the sake of his people. That's what we're watching now. We're watching the unfolding of his providence. And so we come to the chapter, to the end. Let me just read a few more verses. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted. You see, the beginning of the chapter, she goes, yeah, whatever, go, what, you know, and now she's saying, no, you know, be careful. So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests. She lived with her mother-in-law, and she lived with her mother-in-law. That's the end of chapter 2. So chapter 1 ends with the beginning of the barley harvest, and chapter 2 ends with Ruth continuing to glean to the end of the harvest of barley. It's about 2 months. So we've gone from chapter 1 to chapter 2, 2 months of time. And I must admit, now that we've realised that, and Naomi's realised that Boaz is the kinsman redeemer, he's a worthy man, he's a kind man, he's a generous man, I just want to get the show on the road. You know, I just want to think, well, he fits the bill, they can get married, and she doesn't have to keep gleaning, and everything's going to work out. But, I mean, that does happen, spoiler alert, if you haven't read the rest of the book. But I want it to happen now, and yet here they are. Things just keep going on. That just reminds me that God's timing doesn't always work with us. I don't know how Ruth felt about that. I suspect she was just continuing to serve her mother-in-law. But it reminds me, when I want to rush on with things and get things happening, God's timing is not always our timing, and often it means waiting and trusting. It doesn't mean sitting in a darkened room and not doing anything. It means getting on with things and trusting that he will work out his purposes. And remember, where is Ruth right now? Where is she in chapter 2, as well as being in the fields and living with her mother-in-law? She's seeking refuge under the wings of Yahweh. So she's never safer, and we're never safer when we're in that place as well. So that is chapter 2. Now, I would love, because there's so much in chapter 3 and 4, and I would love to do that, but time doesn't allow us to do that. So when you go home, have a look through chapters 3 and 4 and be amazed at how things work. And by the way, the last word in the book of Ruth is David. That takes us forward. And just another little tidbit that I was mentioning to someone in at morning tea, that Boaz, in the genealogy, do you know who Boaz's mother and father are? Yes, Salmon and Rahab. Hang on, did you say Rahab? The prostitute from Joshua 2 is Boaz's mum? Yes, that's right. Which means that Boaz, again, spoiler alert, marries Ruth. He has a Moabite wife and a Canaanite mother. And both those women, Rahab and Ruth, were outsiders who came in because of the compassionate, the loving, the Hesed God who brings people in to be his. I just love that. I love that. But we can't do that here because we're only doing chapter 2. So there you are. So that's just to whet your appetite for what is ahead, which we can't cover. But what do we learn as we think about chapter 2? What do we learn? Well, the question that I raised in the beginning was, where do we go when we're at the end of our resources? And again, I want to focus on two truths about God that help us, teach us to go to him when we are tapped out. The first, and we've touched on it quite a bit, is the providence of God, divine providence. God provides. And how have we seen that in this chapter? We've seen that, we've been reminded that he's in control, that he provides. We see that in terms of Ruth finding herself in the field belonging to Boaz. More than enough food that she takes home to Naomi, providing a close relative who can look after them. And all of this reflects the kindness of God in how he provides. God is the one who provides. So where do we go when we're completely tapped out? We go to him. It's a no-brainer, isn't it? Well, in my case, you know, it's often not the way. But that's a good reminder for us to go to the one who does provide, the one who is good. The second truth we learn when we think about these verses, when we're feeling tapped out and empty, is the truth that we need a redeemer. A redeemer was very important, particularly for Ruth and Naomi, who were vulnerable, no prospects, in desperate need of a redeemer. God provided for them in the person of Boaz. The kinsman redeemer role was, that's what it was there for, to protect and provide for those who were otherwise vulnerable. It was built into God's system to provide the Redeemer. And the next two chapters, you'll see that thread of Redeemer going all the way to the end of this beautiful little family, so to the end when you have Boaz and Ruth and a young child, Obed, and Naomi with the child on her lap. And Obed is referred to as a Redeemer. And Obed being part of the genealogy of David and then part of the genealogy of Jesus. So it all points forward. Because when we think about a redeemer, it's not just in terms of our daily needs in the context of Ruth and Naomi, but it actually points to a deeper need that only the redeemer can provide. So again, you know, when you think about the Bible and there are threads that run through, the redeemer thread, that's a big one. And it takes us, where does it take us? It takes us to Jesus, the Redeemer. The one who has taken on flesh, God in the flesh, who lived a perfect life, died the death we should die, rose to new life, and in him who redeems us from the lost, from being lost, means that we can live with him forever. As the Apostle Paul writes in Ephesians 1:7, he says, the redemption, Jesus the Redeemer, who has accomplished for us redemption through his blood shed on the cross, the forgiveness of sins, the perfect Lamb who has been slain for us. So God is a provider. God is the one who provides our greatest need, and that is the Redeemer, redeeming our lives so that we can be in relationship with God, have peace with him through Jesus' work. So when we think about chapter 2 and what we learn that God is a provider, and he's the one who provides or shows divine providence, and he's provided most wonderfully in the Redeemer. And Boaz points forward to that. But what does that mean for us? I mean, it's all very well. We can understand the book of Ruth. We understand he provides, that there is a Redeemer. But what does it mean for us when we are feeling spiritually, or we're feeling tapped out, exhausted, physically and emotionally? I tell you what I do when I'm feeling like that, being a little bit of a control freak. I do a lot of scrambling. I do a lot of panicking. I do a lot of mental processing. Sadly, a lot of the time I do all of that, and then when all that fails, which it will, then I will go to the one who provides, and the one who is sovereign, the one who is kind, the one who is wise. Why? Why do you do that, Jenny? Anyway, when that word help comes out from our hearts and our heads, you know what the best place to go? Under the wings, taking refuge under the wings of the God who provides. Now, again, that's all very well that we can say that I'm taking refuge under the wings of Yahweh. But what does that actually look like? Again, as we drive out today, what will that look like for us to do that? I want to suggest a few things as we finish up. I think that the more we understand who God is and who we are, finite, infinite, flawed, perfect, powerful, weak, then it will affect how I pray. It will actually drive me to prayer and asking God to provide for me, because that's what he is and that's what he does. So it actually will impact how I pray. You know, the Lord's Prayer is a good example of that. What does Jesus teach us about how to pray? Give us today our daily bread. There is a sense in which God not only works in the big things of life, but in the small things of life. And so we can ask him to provide for us in the daily. That's a right thing to do. I mean, our prayers should not be completely dominated by gimme, 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 but it's actually looking to the one who does provide. So it should impact our prayers. I think also once we understand that we can go first and always to him who is good and provides, then I think that will enable us to be women who take to heart what Jesus says about not worrying. Now, I know it's easier said than done. Don't worry, you know, be happy, whatever that song says. And, you know, Jesus says that there's no need to worry. But Jesus teaches that there's no need to worry, because if God clothes the flowers of the field and feeds the birds of the air, how much more you? Because you are so much more valuable and important to God than they are. So I think that I need to keep reminding myself of who God is, ask him, seek him, and then it actually does take away that worry about life. I mean, it's a daily thing, though. It's not like, you know, once I commit to not worrying, I'm not going to worry. No. I wish that were so, but I'm a worrier. I wish I was a prayer warrior, but I'm actually just a worrier. But the more we understand the goodness and the providence of God, the more we can take to heart what Jesus says about not worrying. And just as a side note, the fact that Jesus says don't worry suggests that he knows we do. You don't say to someone don't worry if they're not worried. So I just like the fact that Jesus understands we do worry. But I think that the more we understand the one who provides in all sorts of ways, it actually frees us up to seek first his kingdom. The more I'm scrambling for myself, the less I'm looking out and wanting to be as Christ to others. The more I understand his providence, the more freer I will be to actually serve and seek his priorities, his kingdom. So that, in other words, having and knowing that hesed of God that comes through knowing the Lord Jesus Christ, that steadfast love that we look at the cross of Christ, the more I'm actually freed up when I understand that to love others with the love that I know. And that's what Jesus says, doesn't he? He says, I want you to love one another. By that, all people will know that you are my disciples. So, when we are feeling completely tapped out and panicking and scrambling, what I want to encourage us to do is to go to him and not to all the other things that we think are going to meet those needs, and know that he does provide. And finally, as we do that and as we see how he provides, think about how thankfulness features in our lives. I think about the way I cry out to the Lord and he answers my prayers. And it's almost like I move on to the next thing that I cry out to, that he answers my prayers. Then I move on to the next thing without acknowledging and thanking him for everything that we have. I mean, the so-called mundane things, like the clothes we wear, the cars we drive if we drive cars, the places we live in, the people that we know who demonstrate that hesed. Are we women who are thankful? Or do we just keep asking for things and getting them and then moving on to the next thing? When we're thankful, we're acknowledging the hand of the sovereign, the good, the one who provides all that we need and so much more. And of course, giving thanks to him for the Redeemer, the Lord Jesus Christ, who has redeemed us and given us abundant life. When we think about empty, full, empty, or full, empty, full, Jesus talks about giving life in all its fullness that comes through him. He says, I've come so that you may have life in all its fullness. Well, let's face it. I mean, the reality is we are all going to feel tapped out. We're all going to do what I did on the drive to Sydney from Canberra. We're going to run out of energy, we're going to run out of petrol, because we are needy people. And this is a world that is hard, and we don't have the resources. But you know what? We know the one who does. The one who loves us with that steadfast love, that hesed, that takes us all the way to the cross of Christ. So no need to scramble, no need to panic, no need to think about where to go, because we know where to go. We know we need to go to the one who provides and seek refuge under his wings. And that is my prayer for us today as we head out. Let me pray as we finish up now.